James, how are you?
Pardon?
How are you, James?
Ah, yes. Here we go. I have been on holiday and there was a swimming pool and I thought...
This is a recipe for disaster.
I would like to swim in that pool.
You fool, James.
I know.
You're a fool to yourself.
I love it, though. I love swimming in water.
In water?
Yeah.
This just gets worse.
It's my favourite thing to swim in, really.
Oh, what happened?
Well, I'll get to the downside later. On the upside, I've discovered that if I wear goggles and go underwater, I can see. I don't need my glasses.
Okay.
I think
you're the first person to notice that.
Really?
Wait, have you been wearing glasses? Have you been swimming in your glasses up until now?
Well, I've been on the surface, sans glasses, everything blurry.
Guessing where everything is.
But you pop goggles on, it's still blurry above surface, go underwater. It's almost 2020. I don't think I could stay under there long enough to do a full eye test.
Well, so I guess water does magnify a bit.
Yeah.
Does it? So it magnifies the exact amount your eyes need.
I guess so.
So instead of lenses, you could just have a little bit of seawater in front of your eyes. That's what you need to do. Fill the goggles with seawater, pop them on with the water on the inside and walk around.
Oh, God.
But you'd be able to see for free.
Yeah, it would sting.
Yeah, but think of the money you'd save, James.
But on the downside, affecting one of my other major senses, my ears filled up with water and I can't hear better when my ears are full of water. It turns out I hear worse.
Oh, it makes it worse, does it?
Yeah.
So you can't hear anything I'm saying?
No, I'm just guessing from context, from visual clues.
That's incredible. You're doing very well.
Yeah, I am down a well.
Classic. Classic banter from you there. Classic hard of hearing banter. So basically, do you need a couple of weeks off to recover, James? Is that the issue?
I do. I am applying a traditional remedy that is olive oil based.
What?
At the moment to melt the wax in my ear to release the water that's trapped behind said wax.
You make it sound so delicious.
Tell you what, it also has rosemary and garlic in it. And it makes my ears smell like a delicious roast dinner. Honestly, it smells like a good salad dressing round here, round my face at the minute. So basically, what I need to do is invent ear goggles.
Yeah.
And wet glasses.
Yeah.
And then I'll be, I could sack this podcast off. I'll be king of the hoops. King of the hoop?
Yep.
Cock of the hoop?
King of the hoops. No, I'm pretty certain king of the hoops is the phrase. In that case, you take a couple of weeks off to work on those ear goggle projects that you're describing.
Yeah. Fill out my Dragon's Den application.
And I guess we'll just stick out some of the outtakes, shall we?
Some of the formerly paywalled bonus episodes.
Oh, sorry, bonus episodes we call them.
No, yes, we call them bonus episodes.
We don't call them the bits that weren't good enough for the... main podcast, we call them bonus episodes as if
that's
they're better.
Right. Yeah. I think shove out gives the wrong impression as well.
What do you want? Sluice?
Yeah, like a home ear syringe kit.
Yeah, exactly.
That you could buy illegally off the internet.
Don't
off the
do
dark
that.
Web.
We advise you to not do that. And we are doctors. We are doctors, but we advise against it.
I don't know about the olive oil thing. People have been doing it
yeah,
for
don't
thousands
do that either.
Of years. And as a cure, but people also have been getting off with frogs as a cure for coughs. So here's a load of extra Robin Ince stuff.
I was going to mention Bertrand Russell. I was about to say friend of the show. He's not. But I'm sure I've done an impression of Professor Yaffle in a previous episode, which is pretty much the same thing, isn't it? For the benefit of anybody who isn't familiar with Bagpuss, there is a rather snooty bird character who you find out many years later was based on the philosopher Bertrand Russell.
Isn't that a great thing when you find out that those bits of, you know, and it used to just be, hey, kids' television, were they on drugs or what, etc. And now that we've actually gone further into seeing things like the work of Postgate and Furman and of Eric Thompson, the richness of children's television in terms of the reference points,
yes,
which mean nothing to you and which are not important that they mean nothing to you. But when you grow up, you suddenly find here is a, and I think that's a really great thing. I think that's one of the, I mean, in some ways I will connect it to the folkloric idea, which is all of these different things that can connect you to real useful and fascinating information, and their richness still remains, and their ability to educate still remains as well, I think is a very beautiful thing.
Yes, I think you're right. When you revisit kids' shows, you either find them to be incredibly shallow and unsatisfying, and that they've lost all of the magical resonances they had for you when you were a kid, or you discover that, like you say, they have this weird depth to them, because I don't know why we're continually surprised that kids' shows are made by grown-ups with grown-up interests and that those things creep into the show.
And I do think there's, having worked on a few kids' shows, the what I always found interesting when I used to do more kind of writing for TV and radio was there was far more freedom in where your imagination could go. The limitations when you would work sometimes on late night Channel 4 current affairs comedy shows in terms of the, just the so few jokes that you were allowed. And then you get to work on a kid's sketch show and you could just run wild in a really interesting, because I mean, Oliver Postgate's an interesting figure as well, because it, in later life, one of the things he did, for instance, was he worked very hard with a charity that bought up all the poppies during the war in Afghanistan, the second or third time, I'm not even sure what the delineation is between the number of conflicts that were there. He helped fund buying up all the poppy farmers' poppies, because what was basically happening was all these people who were at that point, it was being used for the heroin industry. They were just having their crops destroyed. And so this then led to poverty and all that. And he kind of looked into it and he's like, oh, okay. He was also connected with the kind of finding an acceptable way of dealing with the opiate industry without destroying the people who were just farmers who were just growing poppies.
Wow, I didn't know that about Oliver Postgate.
He's an interest. They're both, but him and Fermin both. I mean, that folklore that you see in Noggin the Nog is such a beautiful, that's what I find interesting about when you start looking at folklore and you start to connect it to some of the landscapes you might have visited, is that quality that it gives you, which I've never, I don't know what it is. I've talked a lot about the last kind of trip I had before the lockdown began was to Stornoway, where I went to the Stones of Callanish. And the Stones of Callanish are an older stone circle than Stonehenge. And they're fascinating rock because it's that kind of rock which is has many different...
Quite chewy?
It's really chewy, yeah. It is. Yeah. This is one of the problems.
Talking Hubba Bubba levels.
It is delicious.
Well, this is why Stonehenge, of course, has a fence around it now. It's nothing to do with the Druids. They found out how delicious it was. There used to be a lot more. So this is... God, I didn't know how Moorish a henge could be.
Oh, just a little bit of black pepper on that dolman.
When you touch those rocks, there is that sensation that you get, which is not really quantifiable, where you get that sense of all of the time that has passed, and you get a sense of all of the different events that may have happened there and the events that are yet to come. And I think that that's one of the things that I like about a lot of the kind of when folklore and landscape connect, is it is this way of suddenly you just get, you can have kind of visions, really. You look across a landscape and sometimes, like in the Chiltern Hills, for instance, thinking about the fact that the reason it's made out of chalk is because this used to be a sea. Mm. And, you know, you can go up to, you know, places like Matlock up in the Peak District, and places there, you know, that they have a coral, basically what's a coral reef pretty much. It's a reef, and all of those. And then when you connect that to these kind of, you know, all manner of different strange stories of hill people, you know, who would steal the horses and turn them into fabulous things, or the kind of fiction of Alan Garner and people like that. Mm. And when you then go to the locations where it creates an incredible richness, I think, which means that, I don't know, I shouldn't have had that coffee actually. Jack Kerouac was wrong. It's not performance enhancing at all. But it does. It's that bit which allows you to have, in some ways, a vision which allows you also to still hold on to some form of sanity at the same time. Before, when you were talking about, you know, Grimm's Dyke and the idea that it would go across, you know, the around the whole world, and thinking about 1857, could that really be true? And then you actually realise how the limits of travel that people had and the limits of knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think even when I was growing up in the 70s, like in this village, there were still, you know, the characters. There was a woman called, you know, who was known as Old Viley, who lived in a little house that was filled with cats. And when my sisters were walking down to a farm one day, just come up to them and went, "There's a policeman down there who arrests little girls in blue anoraks." And they ran away screaming. And she was this kind of strange, quirky figure. My godfather, Bob, once gave her a lift in his car and then couldn't get rid of the smell that had been left in the car and eventually got rid of the car. And there were still various people who lived around who carried with them stories. You know that bit of this, we don't quite know whatever happened to him, but he comes out sometimes late on a Tuesday. He waves at the moon and then goes back in. There was still, you know, even that in the same way that in the UK you have that interesting, especially I think in the south of England, if you look at the change in accents, where, you know, watch any footage of kind of Dennis Potter going back to the Forest of Dean in the 1960s, and you can barely understand what people are saying. The dialect, there still wasn't that much travelling. And many people might spend their whole life living in a village thinking, wouldn't it be amazing one day if we started walking around that dike just to go to Australia? and we could be there by February, probably. You know, all of those things are, and now we have this incredible influx of information, and we find that many people, as you said, are wanting to return to. No, it's definitely flat. And you go, oh, it turns out there is a resistance somewhere in our minds. In the Goodies file by the wonderful Goodies, it came out at a time when there were so many, you know, the 1970s had so many kind of books about, you know, UFOs and ghosts and hauntings and things. And there was, and they had lots of parodies, and the lovely parody about the shy ghost. and he was a shy man. He was known for being a shy man. And he promised that after he died, he would return and hide from anyone who visited the house. Cynics may scoff, but I can tell you now that his ghost has never been seen. And what's beautiful about that is, I'm sure you've had this where when you sometimes talk to people who have very kind of vivid and energetic beliefs in some of the kind of, you know, afterlife visitation things, is the brilliant logic, in the same way the brilliant logic of UFOs, you know, one of the things that shows that UFOs definitely visit is because they've never been seen.
Of course,
because they are so technologically advanced and so intellectually advanced that they know to make sure. So it almost is less likely.
It's the Donald Rumsfeld Iraq War evidence argument that the absence of evidence shows the sophistication with which Saddam is hiding the munitions plants. Mm.
Yeah, it's a great bit, though, isn't it? Because people will often bring up the fact that is, you know, that statement is philosophically useful, but less so when it's dealing with very specific, tangible weapons. As an idea of, in terms of
when you're pointing at a photograph, an aerial photograph of not a weapons factory, going, there must be one there. Mm. You're not doing philosophy super well.
Also, that may not have been Saddam Hussein's ghost. It may have been one of his looky-likey bodyguards.
The lawmen drinking game that some of our listeners, our more foolish listeners, play. Yeah. Whenever something turns to dust, they have to take a shot, because especially in stories James tells, the evidence that is presented is usually that the object that would have proven the thing happened crumbled to dust.
To dust.
And the absence of that object verifies that the whole story therefore must be true.
It simply must be dust.
It must be dust.
It must be dust. I think I had one odd serendipitous thing is my Grimm's Dyke up our way is where it's linked to, oh balls, I can't remember the name of the
you don't
house.
Want that. That's a medical situation.
It's linked to the manor house. I can't remember the name of it, but it was Winston Churchill's other, like, during the war, it was the place where he went on moonless nights, I think, because the one that the Crown was recreating was quite well lit.
Right.
So they knew that the bombers would be able to see that one. So he had like a secondary bolt hole. And there's apparently an underground tunnel from there to Woodstock, to Blenheim Palace, which is where he was born. Oh. And they always talk about there being these underground tunnels around there. And underground tunnels is a classic part of folkloric fairy type
So is it said that Churchill would be found scurrying down those holes?
Maybe singing.
Or did he make use of them to avoid Jerry? Is that the idea?
I think it just that he could pop home. It seems to be the only reason for it.
Sometimes you do wish that when it's late at night.
Maybe he needed to feed that black dog.
Robin, have you ever had a supernatural experience? Now, I know that you're a skeptic and a rationalist, so I'm nervous to ask.
Well, no, I'm not, because I'm fascinated by why we see ghosts, and I really do find it. I don't think I ever have. I remember staying down in Cerne Abbas, and my wife saw a ghost, but also knew it wasn't a ghost. But she did have that experience of when walking to the bathroom in the pub late at night. And I think it was the number of mirrors that were on the you know, just enough reflective surfaces to do that wonderful trick. And then,
because if you have a certain number of mirrors,
you're going to call up a ghost.
Yeah, as we all know, I think it's seven.
Can't be helped.
Is the number of mirrors. Seven mirrors equals ghosts.
That used to be the old BBC building where the comedy department used to be was one of those places where it had just enough doors that were quite reflective, and the way that they closed would create that kind of just not quite an infinite regress, but enough to at least find the face of some demonic monster. Lord Reith's back and he's furious with what we've done with the place.
And that's where jokes come from.
Yeah.
Seven mirrors, ghosts, eight mirrors, jokes.
Yeah, in fact, you can watch any sitcom made between 1968 and 1985 and work out how many mirrors were in the writer's room. And it's
some episodes they got it wrong and it was just ghosts all the way through. No jokes at all.
I don't think I've ever had any experience that has remained with me as a belief that I've, but what I do get mentioning before about that kind of, you know, the vision thing is, and it's the one that really sticks with me is walking. I was doing the science festival in Cambridge and I'd done a show on a Sunday night and it was just really quiet afterwards. I had a couple of drinks at the Union and then went walking back to my hotel, and I walked past, I can't remember what it's called. It's one of the roads which just has an enormous number of those kind of beautiful old colleges there. And it was so silent. I'd just gone past the market square and I got a very vivid vision of basically hundreds of bicycles from the last 150 years. Like the idea that suddenly I was seeing, I think before we started recording, mentioning that thing about the palimpsest of time. And it was like all of these different people and they're, you know, on top of each other. So it was kind of overlaid image of just all of these people cycling, these professors and these students, and some of them 19th century and some of them 10 years ago. And it was just, it just kind of came to me. And I'm fascinated by things like that, where every now and again I will get a something will just come into your mind. That bit where your imagination, and it's a bit of your imagination you weren't even aware that you were imagining it, kind of overlays itself into a point in your senses where it's almost as if you are seeing it. So it goes, you know, that it's not the same as that bit where sometimes a dream clings on for long enough that you have to really argue against it for a while. It's not quite like that. It almost does feel like a vision. It does feel like, oh, there, I just, that thing became a real thing, even though I know it didn't exist. So I think that's kind of been the nearest I would have to any, I mean, that's what I generally think with ghost stories, and that is we really, once we start, it's what I find fascinating about William Blake, you know, William Blake being able to live in, have these different levels of reality and to have more than one reality, because we are from the point of our education onwards, I think things are made, again, very linear and there is a single reality. And I think it means that sometimes we don't play with all of the other realities that our imagination conjures up. And then because of that, I think that can sometimes lead to people going, this was definitely real, because your imagination has been so undermined that the fact it can be so rich as to create ghosts for you.
I think I'm sort of on a similar page to you, Robin. I'm very interested in why people think they see ghosts and what, like, in some cases, yeah, there is that dream thing, but there are other cases where it may be, and I don't for a second think it is a actual person, spirit or something like that, but what it is, it's like to say you don't believe in ghosts is to almost say that you don't believe in dreams. Yeah, dreams aren't real, but they are real. it's just sort of, it's just more of a semantics thing.
Yeah, it's a real, yeah. It's the memory of a real sensory experience. Because there is that kind of leaden skepticism, the sort of party pooper skepticism, which, and it's not like the skeptic slash atheist community is without its problems. I suppose it's what William Blake is complaining about with his capital R reason, the sort of dull, leaden reason that he despises. But I think most of the skeptics I know and am interested in would just love to see a goblin.
Yeah.
Mm. Just absolutely living to just meet a little hobgoblin.
Mm.
And we don't think it's going to happen, but oh, I'm ready for it.
It'll be fun.
Like, see, I don't think I want to meet a hobgoblin. I don't want to meet a hobgoblin, no.
Sounds a little racist.
I've just been watching American Gods, and that leprechaun is particularly violent as well. So, but it is... have you spoken to Hayley Stevens on this ever?
No, I don't know.
Hayley's great. She's and what you were just saying about the skeptic community, she's written some very interesting stuff about her. She used to do stuff with Michael Marshall, who's excellent, who's runs the Merseyside Skeptics, which is a really good skeptics organization because it is so much about understanding our needs and understanding when it becomes pragmatic and important. So they've done very good investigations into bull cures for cancer, which are misleading people into a very dangerous place.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that what we need to do to some extent is to loosen our sense that we have to be right. So that moment you go, I'm telling you, I saw the ghost of, or I'm telling you, it breaks the second law of thermodynamics, so it doesn't. That bit of realizing, and in fact, John Higgs's new book about William Blake is very good at looking at the psychology of Blake and looking at the experience of Blake and understanding Blake from actually part of by understanding how the mind works and how the fact that, you know, as you both know anyway, we're not objective observers. You know, there is that thing which many philosophers have said before and now I think neuroscience psychologists, which is, you know, it's not that what we see just goes into our brain and is read, that the mind meets the eye and it draws the picture. And I think all of those things, I think the older I've got, the more I've become fascinated, because for a while I think I would have been closer to what might be seen as kind of, you know, some loose sense of scientism. And now I'm more and more interested in why we have the stories that we have and how useful they can be, and finding that. And Hayley Stevens, who's a paranormal investigator, when she was young, she very much believed in ghosts. And now she doesn't, but she's fascinating in terms of going to investigate and finding out why we might have had experiences. Mm. And some of them are fascinating. Like, you know, she has a very good knowledge now of plumbing, you know, of what, and she has a very good knowledge of up and down currents in old chimneys, you know, all of those kind of things. But at the same time as well, it's never just about going, and thus I have proved. And of course, I've worked with scientists, I think, who do have a very specific kind of view of science just does the research and it does the experiments and then it gives you the result. And I always think that is the dangerous thing, which I do think it is the best method of getting to a good result, especially when it comes to pragmatic things like vaccinations, etc., and dealing with diseases. But I think it's so important not to, again, it's that bit of the humanity of it, of saying, and there are egos involved. And there are, just before this, I was talking with someone about fMRI, you know, fMRI, the hope that we would find out by brain scans that bits of the brain did different things and we put together the jigsaw. And then you go, oh, bloody hell, it is more complex than that. And there's all these connections. But you can't, you know, immediately get rid of the fact that also there's institutions going, we've spent a fortune on this. And we look at sometimes some of the poor decisions that NASA has made. And you look at, you know, things like Challenger. You know, decisions were made there which were not scientific decisions. They were decisions that were made for financial reasons. And sometimes for ego reasons and for all of those things. And I think, you know, we lose so much of the story if we just turn it to we've got the facts and these have to be right because that's the system that we used.
I'm afraid I'm looking at the time and I realise we haven't scored the story.
Well, I don't think we've started yet, have we?
So I think we need to move to a rapid score section, James, because I know you have a hard out in about 10 minutes time.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I'll just very quickly say, the story we were mainly going to talk about, which we didn't about, which was on Easter Sunday, it turned out someone was actually murdered in the village. And it's a very, very sad story involving a murder that was actually committed by the daughter of the boxer Gene Tunney, who had gone missing in Europe and then returned. And when her husband first moved into the village and said, "I've lost my wife," people used to think, oh, that his wife had died. And then they found out, no, he literally meant he went to Europe and his wife disappeared. And then she returned, and then tragically she killed him. And there were I picked up loads of bits of old news. I started to look for some news cuttings because I knew that I was doing this, and it's very interesting the way that it was written about, because he was seen as a bit of a hippie who was known around the village as, which I've not found out from anyone that he was known around, but it's an interesting way that the story was. It's a sad, it's a tragic story with many kind of possibilities of reading in all different ideas about cults and whatever, but that was the story we were going to cover. Please go on to the scoring.
Yeah, so that was the story Robin told me he was going to tell, which we didn't perhaps get around to, because too many films were produced in the 1970s for us to be able to fit that into the podcast.
How much do you have to cut this down to? James, I hope literally you are, when you go out to look after the kids, it's that you're just kept in the shed until that moment. And then each time they're just there. That's kind of, that's a lovely image.
And we should get him back to actually tell that story properly one day, shouldn't we?
I spoke to him at the Edinburgh Fringe and he seems like he's up for it. So maybe it will happen.
Mm. Oh, well, then we could pretend that's a trailer for it as well.
It could even be, in a way, it could even be a trailer for that if we had in any way planned this.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Huh.
Next time, eh? Oh, come and see us live.
Yep, live shows. James's ears will be fine. Come and see a man wearing goggles across his entire face.
Yeah, I'm going to get some mouth goggles in there. Yep. We'll see how that works.
So that's the 17th of September in the Bill Murray Islington.
Yes.
For Lawmen Live again, or Lawmen Live again. It's not clear. It's not clear. And it's actually confusing that we've called it that, James.
If anything, confusing.
People don't know what it means. It's confusing. It's confusing.
Fortunately, though, I found a pun that's baffling in every accent.
Yeah, well done. Well done. And then again, Halloween, the 31st of October, as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival in South London's glittering Balham.
See you there.